Thank you, Joanna, and welcome, everybody. It's great to see you here this morning, and I'd like to thank my four panelists for joining me for this session. The format of the session is that we will hear from each of the panelists. They'll tell us something about the way their firm goes about the investment process and the role of technology in that. After that, we will take three questions, and each panelist will address the question in turn. If there is time, we will open to the floor, but as Joanna's already said, the focus of this session is hearing from our panellists this morning, and then we get the chance to explore those ideas later in the breakout sessions. I'll leave the biographies up there for the moment while we hear from each of our four panellists, and then I'll put up the questions that we're going to address. So, the order that I'd like to hear from the panellists, Nathan, I'd like to hear from you first, followed by David, then Jeff, and then Christine. So, Nathan, if you could open the session for us, please.
Sure. Good morning, everybody. I guess I'm here to represent fundamental research in a kind of traditional sense. I'm a head of research. I represent 20 analysts based in London, and we are very big consumers of financial statements. Usually we try to get financial data into a spreadsheet where we can more easily manipulate it, and our interpretation of financial statements is massively influenced by corporate access. So to give you a sense of the size of that effort, in 2018, London-based investment professionals, portfolios, managers and analysts met with 2,038 companies. About 700 of those meetings were overseas in 56 different cities. So we consume a lot of financial statements. We need to get financial statements into consumable format as quickly as possible, but we are augmenting the process of interpretation and corroborating investment theses through discussions with management with increasing use of alternative data. Alternative data comes out with much higher frequency than financial statements. It tends to be real-time rather than backward-looking. And oftentimes we can go into a meeting and know more about a company's operating performance than the management. So investors are forward-looking. We're trying to make assessments about the future, and financial statements are the basis upon which we build our forward-looking assumptions, but only the basis. So the way I think about financial statements is they're things we look at through the rearview mirror. We're trying to peer through the windscreen to work out where the vehicle is going, and we're doing so at speed. So that's a brief introduction to our usage of financial statements. I mentioned a bit about alt data. We are fortunate as a firm, Lazard Asset Management, to have a quantitative practice in-house. That means we have data scientists in-house, and a lot of what we do is making fundamental analysts work better with quantitative analysts to consume more data more quickly and integrate alt data sets into our forward-looking assessment of the companies that we're investing in.
Thank you, Nathan. I'd like to go to David now.
Thank you. Good morning. I guess then, in contrast to Nathan, I'm the sort of the other side of the investment sphere here, coming from the quantitative business of BlackRock. Obviously, BlackRock is a very large asset manager, the largest in the world, but on a standalone basis, we're one of the largest quant teams globally. I think the relevance to me being today is that we've been on a multi-decade journey in the types of data that we use. In contrast to the sort of investment process, the analyst-driven process that Nathan described, we cover 15,000 companies globally, and one of our researchers has never met a company that we would actually want to invest in. Everything is done in terms of data analysis, understanding the merits of individual companies, industries, countries across multiple different dimensions of data. The individuals that we employ span from accounting professors at one end, economists in the middle, to a large team of data scientists based in San Francisco and London. The journey that we've been on has seen us move from pioneering quantitative investing in the 1980s, where we predominantly consumed accounting data. So if we looked at the automated models that we designed and built and scored and picked stocks and built portfolios with in the 80s, probably upwards of 90% of the data that we used was accounting data. Where we stand today, we're at completely the other end of the spectrum. Probably only 10% of the data that we use is accounting data. The other data is some of the things that have already been referenced by Nathan. It's alternative data. It's data that is not coming from traditional sources. It's data that is vast in size. We work with about 3 terabytes of data per day. It's changeable, it's large, and it's coming from very different places than company accounts. It's coming from the digitization of daily life, whether you're an individual, a corporation, or a government. Much of what you do either happens online or when it happens in the physical world is some way stored digitally. And we've made it our focus to try and access as much of that data, interpret it, and build it into our investment process.
Thank you, David. We'll go to Jeff now.
Thank you, Anne. So as the data vendor on the panel, I think it's my role to talk about, you know, how we manage and distribute data. And in fact, it's great to have my customers on the panel here. So as Refinitiv, which if you're not familiar with the name, it's the new name for what was the financial and risk business of Reuters, of Thomson Reuters. And so we distribute huge range of different types of data to our sort of 250,000 different individual users through desktop software applications to access pricing, news, accounting data, but again a broad range of huge range of other types of data sets. And actually our business has changed dramatically in that, as Dave was saying, probably in the 80s, the majority of our customers would be using those software applications and logging in and looking at data. But now over 70% of our business is delivering the raw data or our augmented data feeds directly into our customers for them to run their own models on, for them to pull apart and recombine to build their strategies. And we've seen a huge increase in consumption and demand for the breadth of data and the frequency of delivery of that data as well. Within Refinitiv, we serve both the buy side financial analyst, the sell side financial analyst. We service in investment banking, the senior banker and the junior banker, so the people doing M&A transactions. Those are some of the largest consumers of the raw financial statement data and the real details, all the way through to the BlackRocks of this world, the very large, very sophisticated quantitative asset managers who are consuming, again, the full spectrum of our data sets. We don't really deliver to the individual or the retail investor, but we do deliver through to retail wealth. So the broad kind of retail wealth customer or high net worth customer, again, there tend to be using more traditional standard kind of accounting data for them to make their decisions. So it's an interesting perspective that we have across the kind of consumer, all the different consumers of kind of financial data. And I guess one of the things that we also see is this change in terms of the consumption of alternative data sets. So, back in the 80s, an alternative data set would have been estimates data. So sell-side analysts providing forecasts of how a company is going to perform and producing those. We aggregate that data and we deliver those forecasts out, and the market moves. People make their decisions based on those forecasts. And I think one of the things we can perhaps discuss in the panel is how the types of data that people are using has changed, and also the structure of the market and how regulation like MiFID has also changed where people are seeking to get their data from. I think we can go into that later as we go through.
We will, indeed. Thank you, Jeff. Christine.
Thanks, Anne. Good morning, everyone. I represent a data vendor, but I come from a very specific perspective in that we ingest XBRL data. So my background is I was part of the core team at the SEC that built the first XBRL taxonomy in the US. And my co-founder, Emily Huang, she previously co-founded a company called Rivet Software. And that company provided software and services to public companies in the US to help them file their financial statements with the SEC using XBRL. So we come from a very XBRL-centric perspective. Having said that, what we do at Idacity is we ingest the XBRL data and we process and normalize that data literally within seconds as soon as the filing hits the SEC's website. That information, that data is available to investors and analysts and companies on our platform. Our platform, the way that I think about our platform is essentially a marriage between Bloomberg and Tableau. So it allows the individual to access the data very quickly, easily, be able to drill down into the footnote information with one click of a button, and be able to very easily visualize that data in different chart forms and graphs. What we also do is, because of our technical XBRL background, we leverage the XBRL framework to go beyond just the financial statements, just beyond the face statements and the footnotes. What we have done is we have, quote-unquote, XBRLized other parts of the document. So in essence, we've structured the management discussion analysis section. We also structure the earnings release, so that we now can do auto-tagging of the non-GAAP information, that rich information that is available within the MD&A and the earnings release. And we haven't stopped there. We've started also XBRLizing the proxy statements to capture important information in there on executive compensation, audit fees, and so forth. And basically, the way that we see the information contained in all of the formal filings to the regulator, all of that from our perspective is fair game, that we can actually go ahead and structure that information. And the reason why we kind of moved in that direction is because we see that XBRL provides a very strong foundation for a lot of innovation to happen. And we hear from the market all the time, as you've heard from the panelists here, that investors are looking for other sources of data. And a lot of investors we hear and companies themselves are very interested in the non-GAAP data. There has been a lot of discussion in the US about requiring companies to tag the non-GAAP data with XBRL. In response to that, we have, basically gone ahead and innovated and done that. And that will come, I think, at some point, given the interest in non-GAAP data, but we, as a data vendor, don't have time to wait for that. So that's what we've done. So again, I'm going to be a lot of my discussion today is going to be very much focused on the XBRL aspect of the financial statements.
Thank you, Christine and others. So we've had a taster now of the type of work that our four panellists are involved in, how technology is impacting on that, and indeed the great amount of change that's been going on. So we'd like to explore that further with four questions. They're in your slide decks and they're up on the screen. So our first question for the panellists, we've already touched on this, but we'll go deeper now. How has technology changed the investment process over the years? What did you do in the past compared to what you're doing now? And how do you expect, doing some more crystal ball gazing that some of you have to do a lot of, how do you expect that technology will impact onto the investment process into the future? So I'd like to start with Nathan again and then go to David.
I've been an investor since the mid-1990s, and I've worked with people who remember having to physically go to the stock exchange to pick up a company press release or financial statement. So I guess the biggest change is digital distribution. That's made everything instantaneous, and with the digital data deluge, the volume of data that's available to influence investment decisions has grown exponentially. I mean, it's almost beyond one's imagining how much data you can buy. I think for us, there's a real decision point around how much data you buy. We think the value is in the question. So we try to buy data that helps us answer fundamental questions. The other approach is just to buy all the data that you can. We worry about that because of just the volume of it and the endowment effects that data can give you. But there's no discussion around the idea that share prices are increasingly influenced by non-financial data. And that is not the body language of the chairman as he makes his address at the AGM. That can be everything from social media feed to satellite imagery of what's going on in ports and what's happening up the supply chain. So there are massive amounts of non-financial data influencing the prices of securities, and therefore the investment process has to move to reflect that. So there's a question about push and pull. In my view, the cat is out of the bag. So financial statements have diminished in their importance to investors. What does that mean for us? It means we're seeking to exploit as much data as we can, but doing so in a way that we regard as fundamental. So I'm not interested in correlation, I'm interested in causality. Financial statements measure some degree of causality, and it's the extrapolation of causality is the way we seek to generate alpha for our clients. So that remains the focus, but we're doing so in a much, much noisier landscape. And what's clear around anything digital is that things become old incredibly quickly. So a financial statement that is produced 6, 8, 10 weeks after a period end is history. It's completely history as far as people making investment decisions are concerned. So I'm very supportive of faster digital transmission, but also the faster production of financial statements, because they really do risk becoming irrelevant to the time horizons that investors have. I'm still positive about the future for financial statements. I'm an analyst, that's kind of what I believe in. But I think accounting standards need to be restated less frequently. That creates massive amount of complexity for the interpreters of financial statements. And they do need to be available in a more timely fashion and much more easily affordable in terms of the way that they can be digitally consumed. So a lot of my analysts spend hours and hours a day taking data from different places, some of it's in financial statements, some of it's in MD&A, some of it's in transcripts, and trying to integrate all of that into a single database of information. I would love for that to be a much more efficient process. And I think the more that this body can do to enable financial data to achieve parity with other data sources, the more relevant financial data will be. We'll leave it there.
Thanks, Nathan. You've given us a lot of challenges there. David, over to you.
Maybe I'll frame it a little bit in why we've taken these efforts to move away from slightly more traditional data to so-called alternative data, and using machine learning to analyze some of those things. The key thing here is everything that we do is about trying to deliver for clients. It's about trying to beat the market, outperform index in our long-only strategies. It's about trying to deliver consistent absolute returns for our clients in our hedge funds. The reason that we've had to make this shift is that many of the ideas, many of the factors that we develop from traditional data sources do not allow us to do that in the way that they did historically. So we've already sort of alluded to it, a couple of us. You know, traditional quantitative ideas in the 80s might have been scoring and ranking 1,000 stocks on a PE ratio from their financial accounts. That was cutting edge quant work in the 1980s. You could generate information ratios, risk adjusted returns on just a ranked PE ratio of stocks in developed markets of something like 2. So for every unit of risk, you could make 2 units of return. there's no, after costs in most developed markets, there's no money to be made from a strategy like that. That information is too easy to access. You don't even need to pay for it pretty much these days. And the opportunity has been arbitraged away. And you see that across many, many different data sources. We've already heard the idea of analyst forecasts as an input and a driver of returns. In the 90s, when an analyst upgraded a stock, there tended to be a bump, an outperformance of that stock. It would sometimes last for weeks. In some markets, you still get that bump over a matter of days, maybe even in a week in somewhere like an emerging market. In Europe, that bump might last a day or two. In the US, if you've not traded that within seconds of the upgrade happening, you're better off flipping the sign and trading the other way against the overreaction to it. So these things get completely arbitraged away. So to continue to develop and continue to generate alpha for our clients, we have to look for different ideas. Now, ours is a quantitative approach, but not dissimilar to what Nathan described. We're still trying to systematize or quantify a fundamental understanding of companies. So we've looked to try and find many, many different data sources that can allow us to do that and can allow us to speed up that process. So if we go back to something like analyst forecasts, you can't trade on that in a lot of developed markets if you trade off the actual upgrade. However, if you take the analyst report and you use natural language processing to analyze the wording around that report, not the numerical forecasts themselves, and you produce a sentiment score using natural language processing from what they're writing, there is a relationship between what they write in their report and their future recommendations. So not every time an analyst puts out a report, they'll make a new recommendation, but often they're slowly changing their thinking, and that comes through in what they're writing until they're 100% confident and change their recommendation, and that can forecast that. So text mining is one way, and natural language processing of pretty much any written document about companies or written by companies in press releases or filings to the regulators are things that we consume. The second element of work that we've done on trying to improve and make the process more robust over the years is the idea of scraping the internet for information. So increasingly, we don't really want to get information directly from companies. We want to get information from people that interact with companies. So that might be people using their products. And how can you do that today? Well, you can look at what they're searching for online. So what products they're searching for. You can look at what types of websites they're going on. You can look at what types of locations, which shops and restaurants and leisure facilities they go in from where their smartphone is. All of these things are increasingly available to us in a digital world. The final thing that I would highlight within our investment process is that, already described, many of these data sets are vast in size, so an Excel spreadsheet is not going to be something big enough to house and interpret that information. It's often faster moving and it's often unstructured. It's often text or pictures. It's not necessarily numbers. So we're increasingly having to use machine learning to analyze that information and incorporate it into our portfolios. So this has been, again, a 20, 30-year journey that has ramped up in the last 10 or so years as that decay in the effectiveness of traditional data has increased. And thankfully, on the flip side, the amount of alternative data has just exploded, again, because of the digitization of the way that we lead our lives. Where do I see that going? It's only going to continue. If you, again, things like smartphone penetration, internet usage is high globally, but it still has further to run in a lot of countries. There is going to be more and more data generated. And for us, it's about trying to find the advances in particular areas. So better I give you a specific example than a sort of a holistic example. We're very interested, again, in what management can tell us. You can look at the wording in accounting filings or regulatory filings. You can look at transcripts of what they say on their earnings calls. But we've actually moved away from just thinking about text sentiment to think about 3D sentiment. There are ways to interpret audio so literally do what was described and a little bit suggested in a negative way earlier about the way that management are talking when they give a press conference. Or even you can look using advanced video cameras to understand some of the expressions they give, or even assess their pulse when they're speaking to assess whether they're telling the truth or not. So all of these things are not current, but they certainly are potentially the future.
Hans will have to think about his presentations and text analysis and video of Hans speaking. Great. Thanks very much. Christine, we're going to... Jeff. Jeff, then Christine.
Okay. So I try and cover something different because I could definitely concur with everything Nathan said and what David said as well. We definitely see our customers asking us to help with those kinds of things or telling us that's what they're doing, which is why they don't need to buy our data anymore, which is sad for us, but it shows the progress that's happening in the marketplace. So there'll be two really concrete examples of how technology has impacted our business in terms of trying to serve investors. So one, on the actual collection and processing of financial statements. So actually we're a consumer of Rivet software and we do process XBRL. But we have to put in an enormous amount of work to then standardise the output, because every company still provides their own individual tags, they still have their own particular line items. Accountants will say it's because that's the way the company wants to express itself. We say that's to obfuscate the ability to do comparisons across companies, so we have to standardise. But the way we collect that data is, you know, really challenging because, as Nathan said, right, there isn't really a centralised disclosure point. If I want to get all the financial reports that are made available in Europe, where do I go? Right? There's not a single place to go. I have to go to every single jurisdiction, every single disclosure environment. We have to pay license fees to access those feeds. If there is a feed, often those feeds are terrible. They don't work very well. So we have to create robots to, you know, go and pull all the financial reports, all the presentations, all the press releases from every company's website, every regulator, every other location. We do that globally. And that's entirely automated now. We used to have a team of maybe 200 people doing that work. Now that's a team of 5 or 6. And so automatically pulling all of the financial reports, all of the press releases, you know, globally, and processing them, marking those up, and getting them ready for our financial team to then extract the financial statements. Again, we used to have a team probably of, you know, a couple of thousand people collecting and pulling the financial values from all of these financial reports. Now that team is around 600 people, their job is 95% automated because, yes, we use XBRL, but we also automatically extract the face of the financial statements, the balance sheets, the cash flows, and we use a whole range of different automation techniques to pull out the statements, to compare them to the previous statements, to do the difference, to check the accounting standard of those values, all those kinds of things. And we used to then put a lot of manual effort in collecting the footnote data. Now we use machine learning to go through, you know, where a company says this is, you know, other depreciation, see footnote, right? We have to then go search that document, find what that breakdown was, attach that breakdown and the structure to that value. And we do that with machine learning now to connect those things together. And then our customers asked us for more. They asked us, well, we want KPIs. We want to know for airlines, passenger miles flown. We want to know revenue per available room for, you know, somewhere like the Hilton. And now we now collect thousands and thousands of these additional, you know, non-GAAP KPIs, which are the KPIs that really drive those in individual industries. Those are the KPIs that management talk about in their transcripts. They're what analysts provide in their forecasts. And again, we automatically identify and extract and link to the statements, those things, using machine learning. And we do that on a global basis, so we then compare across all accounting standards. So we're using all the technologies that we're using, our customers are also using, right, to do that same work. So that's one example of how we're using technology to change the way we collect and manage financial statements. Just to give a really specific example on alternative data, you've sort of heard this, you know, what does it mean? So I'll give you, I was at an alternative data meetup in London. If you want to learn more about alternative data, come to the Data Scrum meetup. You can learn what people are actually doing. There's a financial analyst at one of the firms talked about what they do. So their analyst, maybe somebody like somebody in Nathan's team, goes, I have a particular view of Merlin Entertainment. If you don't know Merlin Entertainment, you know, think of Legoland or Alton Towers. That's what they do. And in the financial statements, they've said, we've made a big investment in a brand new ride at Legoland, right? And so the investment thesis for Merlin is, are they attracting enough people to Legoland to justify this big investment? So I can use mobile phone data. I can geofence Legoland just outside, you know, where the Queen lives, in, over there in Windsor in the west of London. I can put a ring around Legoland, and I can track, I can buy this data from a number of vendors who track mobile phone sort of GPS locations. How many people are travelling along there, making sure I'm not picking up the people travelling on the M25 just nearby. How long did they stay? And then I can also track where they came from. Did they come from wealthier neighbourhoods? Did they come from poorer neighbourhoods? So how likely, if I have a higher proportion of people from wealthier neighbourhoods spending more time in Legoland, it's more likely they'll make their return that investment. And I think the question there is, as David said, the investors now know more about the companies than the management do. There's material information in the public domain about companies that management, if management don't know it, they should. And if they do know it and it's material, they should disclose it. And I think it's a fundamental challenge in this world of alternative data for accounting and for corporate disclosure and for public companies.
I've got my phone turned off. Christine.
Okay, so now I'm going to put my accounting professor hat on. The underlying theme here that I've heard this morning is that the increasing relevance of alternative data sets and the decreasing relevance of accounting information. So I think we're all in this room having probably personal heart attacks thinking about the potential decrease in relevance of financial statements. So I think one thing I took from Nathan and David's discussion is that, you know, the financial statements are historic looking, and you know, when the financial statements are made available to the public, it's old news. So I have a couple of thoughts on that. Given that we now have XBRL, the level of granularity of the information that you can get from the financial statements all the way down to the footnote is instantaneously available. XBRL allows consumers, data consumers, to, with one click of a button, figure out what the effective tax rate is for a given company, for a whole group of companies, for thousands of companies, literally. Jeff mentioned that, you know, with the XBRL, there's a lot of complications in terms of companies creating custom tags and the way that they tag differently. And that's where we see the experience that Emily, myself, and the team that we have in the XBRL space is that we've been able to normalize all of those tags so that we are able to produce data that can be consumed by analysts and investors. Now, the normalization process for us is that, yeah, we go ahead and normalize the tags, but we also show the investor and the analyst what tags were used to normalize to a given KPI so that the investor or the end consumer can figure out for themselves whether they agree with our normalization or not. So the point I want to make here is that the XBRL has metadata that we can exploit to be able to show increased transparency from the data back to not only the tag, but also back to the source location within the document where that number came from. And so from my perspective, I believe that XBRL provides a very good framework for the end consumer if they want to do data validation, if they want to make sure that, be cognizant of where that data came from within a given footnote on page 393, they can do that with one click of a button. So I believe that there's a lot of potential for financial statements to maintain relevance. One thought did come to mind is that, you know, we're talking about the investor perspective, but we're here, you know, at the ISB right? Where, you know, I believe too that standard setters can leverage the XBRL data to write more relevant, more informative, more timely standards. So one of the questions that I often get from the FASB team is, you know, who is early adopting RevRec or the new leasing standard? How are they disclosing that? So the XBRL data provides that mechanism for the standard setters to be able to look at the implications or the behavior of the standards that they've written. So it's a really good feedback mechanism. Feedback loop, and it helps the staff, you know, do more efficient research in terms of understanding how companies are reporting in general in a particular topic area. So, I understand and appreciate, you know, the importance and increasing relevance of alternative data sets, I still believe, putting my accounting professor hat on, that, you know, accounting is the language of business, and that's what I tell all my intro accounting students. And that, you know, I think that there is a place still for accounting information to be timely and relevant and provide a good foundation from which analysts and investors can form their future forecasts from.
Thanks, Christine. Would either Nathan or David like to respond to the challenge that Christine's just thrown out in terms of still a role for financial information from the financial statements?
I mean, I can sort of respond from the quantitative side here, and I'll give a sort of reasonably upbeat response here, especially given the audience. and that is, I mentioned right at the start the switch from being a sort of 90-10 accounting to non-accounting data to the other way around. However, the 90% still needs validation in some way. So the way that we work, there tend to be two types of quantitative investors. There are ones that work in such a short horizon that it generates so much data, you really don't need to have a thesis behind what you're doing. So Nathan somewhat alluded to it. It can be very much sort of correlation, regression, machine learning based. If you're investing over the next millisecond, it really doesn't need to be particularly thesis based. We're not a quantitative investor like that. Again, I would come back to the idea that we've essentially systematized a fundamental investment process. So everything that we do has a thesis behind it. Every new data set that we're looking for, we're trying to assess something specific about companies, industries, countries. One of the problems that we have with a lot of the newer data sets is that they tend to be quite short term. So something like smartphone locations, which is something that we're interpreting within our investment process, the vendor that we're using only had a 2-year history. So you can, our idea was that the thesis is that the more people that go through a certain store, as that improves over time, you're potentially going to see a similar increase in revenues. And if we can understand that footfall ahead of time and ahead of other investors, we can position accordingly. We only had 2 years of data to test that with. So we build a testing model. We test that historically, and it shows that it does add some value to our process. It does forecast outperformers and underperformers, but it's 2 years. Can you trust a 2-year period when you want to go and use that for the next 5, the next 10 years? However, if you also do what we call an ancillary test, you test that information about its ability to forecast some fundamental number, a fundamental number that you know has a relationship to outperformance and underperformance in the market. So a thesis like this would be revenues. It would be, can you show that because more people went into McDonald's restaurants that they see a commensurate increase in the revenues that they have generated? Now, again, you can only test that for 2 years. However, you've got revenues for 30, 40 years for McDonald's. And if you can see that there is a relationship between the changes in those revenues and the performance of McDonald's in the market, if you knew that you could forecast that revenue from a new data set, it gives you quite a lot of confidence on the fact that even you only had a 2-year history, that it should work going into the future. So a lot of that 90% is still calibrated and tested on accounting data. So it might not be in a direct input in quite the same way, but it is robust accounting information is still something that we would want to consume to help calibrate many of the other more alternative data sources.
Excellent. Thanks, David. Nathan.
I still think there's reasons to be optimistic about the role of financial statements in the investment process. When we make a decision to invest in something, it is because we think that the company is going to grow in a healthy fashion. Hopefully, we believe that we've got more optimistic expectations than those that other people have or that appear to be embedded in the share price, and our thesis will be validated by financial statements in the future. In other words, the measurement of growth, of cash flow, of balance sheet, et cetera. So financial statements are still completely integral to the way we think about the future and we expect to measure it. The question is, in testing our thesis, is a financial statement the largest component in building that thesis and assessing it in real time? The answer is no, it isn't. So it is a rearview mirror for us. No one's mentioned a topical buzzword, and I think it's important that we introduce it at this point, which is ESG, which is more and more investment decisions are being influenced by the need to take account of non-financial externalities to do with the world, the environment, and the rest of society. Now, those lay outside of financial statements, and if there's any single factor that's driving the growth of alt data, it's probably ESG. And this is not speculative investment. I appreciate that, you know, all of the talk about apps on your smartphones hacking your data and being sold to third parties sounds very spivvy, and the idea of trading in microseconds sounds really very, very spivvy. But alt data, where it relates to ESG, is informing real asset owners' decisions about very large amounts of their future investment decisions. So whether it's decisions not to invest in coal, how they manage their climate change exposure by geography, how they think about fossil fuel extractive industries in general. These are all important decisions being made on non-financial data. And that's why this is going to stay. And you know, I think we're looking at a changing rate of interest in this area, which is only going to expand. So I think there will be questions about whether those are auditable, who sets the reporting standards, all that kind of stuff. And I guess one of the other decisions this body has to make is how far it wants to get into that area, but it's going to be very material in the future.
I'm sorry, I'm just going to have to jump in and say one thing on that in response to that, and I thought Nathan's response was great. Data that we would get from smartphone locations is not hacked. So this is information collected in people's app usage that they have agreed to use. It's then when it comes to us at BlackRock has been completely anonymized, so we cannot track an individual where they've been. So I need to put somewhat of a legal disclaimer out there.
No inference was intended.
It obviously does have a lot of sensitivity around it.
Yes.
So,
yes.
And it's obviously something that companies like Jeff's and ours take very seriously as well.
Yes, thank you so much for bringing that up, because that is really on people's mind as we think about these alternative data sources. I'm going to go to question two now. So question two on the screen. We'll take the panellists in the same order as we did for question one. So we begin with Nathan and then David, then Jeff and Christine. So for question two, and we've probably touched on some of this already, but we'd like to explore it more. We appreciate the fact that you're cognizant of the audience and our purpose for being here as IFRS Foundation. So we thank you for your comments already linking back to financial statements and data. But the question is, the implications of the changes that we have noted for financial statements and structured data, and again touching on the question of the relevance of financial statements, financial information, and structured data. So Nathan, first to you.
The observation has been made that financial data is losing market share in terms of the factors that influence decision making. I think that's just modernity. I think it is important that financial data is structured. That's one of the greatest points of its value. And we've talked a bit about backtesting periods, but for me, it's being able to understand company's performance over time rather than imagining that I have a more accurate impression of where it is now. So I think there's an issue about comparability over time, not just between companies, which influences your extrapolation mechanism. So data needs to be timely, needs to be accurate, and it needs to be consistent. So I go back to the point I made about the frequency of financial restatements. That massively adds to the complexity of interpretation. So even if it's correctly tagged, it may be different, and that affects interpretation a huge amount.
Thank you.
Yeah, I maybe make 2 points, and I realise I've used my example already that I was going to give for this one. So I may maybe give one more example here of the relevance of financial data. So something that we do with conference call analysis is we use machine learning to analyse the language used by management teams, transcripts of what the management team are talking about. And one of the ways that we can do that is we can essentially use machine learning to analyze the historical language used by management teams and then look at an output variable. And that output variable is future returns of the company. So what types of language were used by management teams where the company then outperformed over 1 day, 1 week, 1 month, 1 year? And actually what you find is an analysis like that is actually quite quick in nature. So that sort of sentiment of the way the management team speaks tends to pay off in not much more than a week or two. So you need to trade in our world quite quickly to access that potential opportunity. However, we've extended that, and we do the same learning work on the conference call transcripts, but rather than try and forecast returns or understand the language used that then see certain return outcomes, we look at certain fundamental outcomes. So can you pinpoint the types of language used when the company then sees fundamental improvement on certain different accounting metrics? And what we find with that analysis is it pays off over a more like a sort of three quarters type environment, and is actually quite lowly correlated with the other analysis using the same source. So it's another example where we've taken a predominantly unstructured text data source, but we have to feed accounting data into it to make it usable. So again, I would come back and say that it on headline might not seem an important part of what we do, but it's still going to remain, and I don't see it changing an important way that we can analyse so much else of what we do. I would echo the things that Nathan said about the need for it to you know, the sort of what it provides you in terms of interoperability and quality. And I'll add further on the ESG piece as well. I mean, I think this is something that you know, we are increasingly thinking about that in our own investment process. And if you look at the ESG world, it feels a little like accounting data was decades ago, in that a lot of it comes from companies themselves without a lot of standardization in the way it's produced. It can be manipulated in many different ways. And because of that, we almost use no standardized ESG information. It's all collected ourselves from other places. So you know, maybe that is something that needs to be thought about. How can that type of information be incorporated into standardized reporting? And it would then be utilized more by people like ourselves.
So that's a great challenge for us. So we've heard about financial statement data to be timely, accurate, consistent, and then another challenge about what the role of IFRS Foundation is in relation to the ESG data. So let's go now to Jeff and Christine on question two. Jeff.
Thanks, Anne. So again, for the audience, I think the reason we're saying that financial statements are perhaps less important in the overall mix is, frankly, that IFRS has done a great job, right? It's actually become standardised. There's not as much differentiation across companies. So those factors, those financial values are trusted, they're disseminated widely, they're instantly kind of absorbed by the market, which is exactly the way it should be. So it's a bit like, you know, nobody notices that much about, you know, the national grid, although, of course, in the UK we did have a power cut just the other day, didn't we? But because it works, you know, people just assume it's there and you rely on it, and it's part of the foundation and the bedrock. But I think the challenge is, and it has been actually for quite some time, is, you know, if you look at a sector like retail, you know, same store sales are what drives people to look at retail stores, and they're very short lived. You have to understand those are the metrics that drive, and a lot of this alternative data, or a lot of the estimates data, or a lot of the other information people are looking at is around those metrics. Those are the key metrics. And I think it's something that I've talked to members previously on, is does the IFRS have to produce a standard and ask for this value to be audited and approved, you know, right away? Or can the IFRS simply say, this is good practice? We recognise that this is what's happening in the marketplace, and we recognise what's bad practice in the way you account for these non-GAAP values, and this is good practice. And we recognise, actually, that you put your press release out here, and you say something different when you go to your transcript. And in the transcript, you provide additional data that isn't in the filing. And what is your view on that practice? I think starting to talk and openly discuss these kinds of things is exactly the precursor to moving forward and bringing these things, again, out of the kind of Wild West and into the standardised, boring, reliable kind of values. And it would be incredibly helpful for us as investors, as vendors, and incredibly helpful for our customers who spend, you know, huge amounts of time and effort trying to triangulate and pull all these different elements together. So I think that's something that we would like to see. And again, on ESG, we've seen probably in the last 12 months an absolutely massive explosion in demand for ESG data. The disclosure is all over the place across companies. The way they provide it, the way they aggregate it, the way they talk about it is all over there. And it's very expensive and very hard for us to gather and standardise that. And the entire industry is challenged on that front. We've done some surveys, and the volume of money being invested now in funds that have an ESG component, it's over half of the new money flowing into the institutional investment world is using some kind of ESG flavour. It's massive, right? It's not something that's a side discussion. It's not something that's a nice to have. It's absolutely critical. Every customer we're talking to is asking us for, can you give me not the 6,000 or 7,000 companies that we cover today for ESG, but can you give me the entire, you know, 40,000 set of companies, standardised data across all these data elements, and the data just isn't there, or if it is there, it's really difficult and expensive for us to put out. So I would say that's the new frontier. It's not that new, right? I think it's something we really need to catch up on.
Thank you, Jeff. Christine.
So one of the things that we heard this morning is that for financial statements to maintain relevancy, data's got to be accurate, relevant, consistent, and timely. And so, again, coming back to the whole XBRL perspective, I believe that XBRL and the XBRL framework and what you can build on top of the XBRL framework can afford that, for financial statements to maintain that relevancy. One thing I do want to sort of talk about is the importance of the different stakeholders working together on making this possible. So I really believe that for us to get timely, good, accurate data, we need to have the companies take ownership of the data quality, right? So there's been a lot of discussion in the US about companies creating custom tags when they shouldn't, creating tagging in a certain way when they shouldn't. So that reduces the data quality. So I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but XBRL US does publish the data quality committee rules, the errors for every single public company on the XBRL US website. So when I've been on calls with some companies and I show them that dashboard, some of the external reporting folks and the CFOs are happy to see that their company's name is not in that high list errors. So once they realize that people are actually looking at the quality of the financial statements and the tagged financial statements, they become much more concerned about data quality. But I don't believe that that's kind of like a common perspective amongst companies. So I think for us to have good data quality, companies have to take ownership of that. I think that, you know, the regulators have to also start enforcing data quality, right? And so I think there's this kind of, you know, general conception that I hear from talking to companies is, you know, no one's received an SEC comment letter specifically on the XBRL tagging and creating custom tags. And so one of the things that I think that can help improve data quality is having regulators, you know, use the XBRL data for analysis, for enforcement, and actually calling companies out on that. The next thing is, you know, companies themselves actually use the XBRL data to do their own research and benchmarking analysis. So I think as companies, you know, start thinking about how they themselves can exploit the data that's easily available to them, I think that's a feedback loop where they'll start taking the data quality issue a lot more seriously. And the next thing is, you know, in the investor market, it's important for the companies to know what investors are looking for. Also, for from our perspective, the data aggregator, as Jeff mentioned, there's a call for ESG data. So it's, you know, again, it's that coordination, cooperation amongst all the different stakeholders. And then, as I mentioned before, the standard setters, you know, in terms of, you know, making or helping the data be more timely and accurate, you know, for the standard setters to actually also use the XBRL data to help facilitate their research in terms of common reporting practices and what, you know, what other information the market needs from the existing disclosures. Can the existing disclosures be improved? So I think for the technology, you know, to help maintain the relevancy of financial statements and structured data, I believe that all of these stakeholders need to take ownership and partake in a common discussion and dialogue and work together.
Great. Thank you, Christine. I'd just like to go to Nathan or David, whether they have any responses to what we've heard from Jeff and Christine on question two.
Nothing jumping out.
Okay, before we go to our third and final question, which is about what various organisations can do to support investors' needs in this area, I'm going to pause and take a couple of questions from the floor. So, questions from the audience, but please address questions one and two, the things that the panellists have already been talking about. We won't start looking into the future, although we have started to touch on that. So questions from the audience to the panellists, please be succinct in your question and please indicate which panellist you would like to answer the question. You need to turn on your microphone so that everybody can hear your question, and you'll have to excuse me for being rude and just pointing at you because I cannot read the names across this distance, apart from the which they're now standing vertical. So questions succinctly, please, and name your panellist. So I'll start with the lady here. This one, yes, thank you.
So I apologize in terms of naming the panelists because I don't know who would be best placed to answer this question, perhaps all of you. I was curious if you've had much discussion in your firms about how blockchain technology might change the availability and really instead of aggregating, which is a function of financial statement reporting, being able to look at the raw transaction data through blockchain of companies.
Happy to give a go. So I work in our lab, an R&D lab, so we have done a lot of work on blockchain. I think that there has been a huge amount of investment in blockchain. It's actually started to drop away significantly. It's kind of a very slow way of delivering a database, to be honest. So for financial statement data, you know, it's an interesting idea that you could have smart contracts that automatically go out and pull information and it's transparent in terms of what's happening. But actually the cost of operating a blockchain is very high currently, and the speed of how the data moves is also currently too slow really to be particularly useful. I think what we've seen people look at it for things like, you know, supply chains and sharing supply chain type data. But again, I think standard databases we find are actually more than adequate for that kind of thing. So actually, as a firm, we've kind of taken a step back from blockchain. There are some firms, you know, in the marketplace that are still pushing those forward. You know, Santander just issued a bond right, using a blockchain, but actually they issued it to themselves, and they were the only investor and they were the only publisher, so it's kind of, you know, interesting. But for this kind of topic, I don't see particular applications.
Good, thank you, Jeff. David, did you want to add?
I mean, I would kind of echo that. It doesn't seem something that is gaining ground at BlackRock as something that we could use on the sort of internal accounting side or on the investment side. And, you know, and just from coming to events like this and being around the industry, it seems like the chatter on blockchain has dropped very significantly over the last 2 or 3 years as people do the type of work that Jeff was describing and looking into it in detail.
Great. Okay, great question. Thank you. There are 3 other questions up at the moment. Oh, now there's now 4. Let's see how we go. Gentleman here. Yes.
So thank you. I'm Vijay Kumar from India. My request is to David. In fact, you brought out very nicely the fact that the information reliance you're placing on the financial reporting is about 10% and about 90% on the other source of information, which we broadly refer as unstructured data. So I have 2 questions around this for better understanding. One is, if you were to go back 5 years in time, and now, would you say that 5 years back, there was almost a whole reliance only on financial information, and that you see relevance has now come down to 10%, and do you see a threat of that 10 shrinking further? Second, as far as the 90% of the external information which you use, when you connect it with the financial reporting information which is available, do you find that substantial adjustments needs to be done to the information available in the financial reports, to the extent that had this information been available at the time of preparing financial reports, probably financial reports would have been more relevant to you, and consequently its relevance percentage would have been much higher?
That was just 2 questions, was it? Let me try and work through that. So on the numbers, I sort of mentioned, you know, 90-10 in the 80s to 10-90 now. It's been a process to get from one to the other. It's definitely not just one day we shifted. So maybe if I take it back, yeah, so let's do this. 10 years ago, was when we really started the effort in terms of looking for the data, hiring the people that could help us analyze this. 10 years ago, you were probably looking at, you were probably at 75% accounting data in the investment process, and 5 years ago, it was probably down, I don't know, 30% or something like that. These are rough numbers. And just so I clarify this, that 90, you're still going to have some structured data, so some numerical data, sort of market data, would probably make up 30% of it still, but in vast size, and the rest would be the more alternative data types that we've heard: text, images, you know, GPS locations, things like that. The last question is the harder one, is when we sort of calibrate the alternative data against the financial data, and would that mean there need to be some differences in it and things like that? It's less that I'm saying that. I mean, if the accounting standards hold and the quality of the information that comes out is there, it's correct then, and we can calibrate against that. I think I would echo some of the comments made by other people that there is the potential to include other metrics within that. That would be useful, that we would find useful to calibrate the alternative data against as well. So I don't think it's a case that we're not trying to look for inaccuracies in the accounting data. We're looking to the alternative data to give us an earlier read on what that accounting data is actually going to look like. Mm. And we're trying to get an earlier read on the way the market is going to respond to that accounting data, as opposed to saying there's something incorrect in it. But again, we would use that, and I'm sort of front running the final question here, we would use that more and more, that data, if there were more of these metrics that were more comparable to the types of information that we're finding, like footfall, as an example.
Great, thanks. Yes, Jeff.
So I think one thing that I just realised might be useful is, you know, some of these data sets, you know, as a data vendor, we provide, you know, structured data, financial statements, estimates, and so on. But there's a big coverage difference. So there are around, you know, 45,000 publicly listed companies. So for all of those, we would have financial filings, and we would have financial reports. The market has used for a long time earnings estimates. So sell-side analysts providing estimates, you know, of what those future performance of those companies is going to be. That coverage, there's a, you're talking between, you know, 16,000 to 18,000 companies, right? So over half of the publicly listed companies do not have sell-side analyst research coverage. They don't have sell-side analyst estimates coverage, okay? And of those 20,000, or, you know, roughly that kind of number, the number of analysts covering those companies has dropped really significantly, right? Partly because of, you know, it's very expensive to have a sell-side research team. Also, if you look at the impact of MiFID II, it's meant that the whole structure of the sell-side and buy-side and how that works and who's paying who has changed and has kind of put pressure on that. Then if you look down at something like transcripts, we talked about transcripts, so earnings conference calls. They're really expensive to cover and to create transcripts. We cover about 7,000, 8,000 companies with that data. ESG data, we cover about 6,000 or 7,000 companies for ESG data. Right? So even if you're saying that the investable universe is actually the sort of MSCI world, which is about 10,000, 11,000 companies, there's an information gap that you can see, right? So that's why we were looking out for other forms of data. Even if you look at something like news, right, you would think, well, there's good news coverage or even social media coverage of all these companies. There actually isn't. Once you go below the sort of top 10,000 companies, the news flow and the social media flow really drops away. So there's actually a big opportunity to try to bring in and incorporate in some of the KPI, some of the metrics that people have traditionally looked at for the sell side to provide, or these are the sources to provide, into the financial statements, because they are universal in their coverage. And I think that's, you hadn't mentioned some of those numbers, I thought that might be helpful.
Yeah, excellent. I'm going to take a question. Yes, here.
Thank you. It's not necessarily addressed to any particular panel member, but I just wanted to get impressions. In the last couple of years, there's been some major changes in accounting standards, and there will be in the next couple of years as well, the last ones coming through. What impact does that have on the analysis of financial information from your side when you are trying to use financial statements and develop a model out of it?
I'll go on that one. So I'm not a big fan of 16, so apologies for that. So what does it mean in practice? Different companies with different year ends and different reporting schedules will transition to a new timetable at a different point in time. So you instantly lose comparability across your universe. Secondly, the period of restatement is relatively short. So if you want to understand how a company would have performed in a radically different economic environment under a new standard, you have no way of assessing that. So if investing using financial statements is a series of images through the rearview mirror that you're using to extrapolate your direction, it's a bit like someone taking the rearview mirror away. You just lose your frame of reference. So major accounting restatements take a lot of time for investment professionals to reorganize. I have no idea how a purely quantitative investor is dealing with 16. It must be a nightmare because balance sheets have fundamentally changed in size, leverage has changed, you know, a lot of really important numbers have changed. As a fundamental analyst, I think I can work my way around that, but it takes up a huge amount of my time in a period of transition. And that's the unseen cost of changes in financial statements, is the human effort in reinterpreting, resetting databases, reframing context. So it's not something to be undertaken lightly. And as we go back to the trade-offs between accuracy and timeliness and relevance, I think that's a question that you will have to, you know, weigh more carefully. Is by seeking to have a more accurate view of the past, do you reduce the relevance of what you produce for the future?
Does anyone else want to comment on that particular question? Don't have to.
I think it's fine.
Okay, there was another question from this side.
Yes. I would like a comment on the dependence on the investment style of the use of non-financial data. How do you see that across different investment styles, including the trading frequency? And also, could you elaborate on the use of non-accounting data in credit rather than equity investing?
Maybe I can go first, and then I think you probably that second part would be relevant to something we discussed before. I mean, so on the frequency side, and I'm talking about this from as an equity investor, and I'll answer from the quantitative side, the shorter the horizon, the higher the frequency. Certainly, the more machine learning is utilized as the analysis tool, because if you're working millisecond by millisecond, the amount of data that you have is exponentially larger. However, a lot of that data wouldn't necessarily need to be unstructured or alternative in the sense. I mean, again, smartphone, and again, we keep using this as an example, but it's a good one. Smartphone location is it could be instantaneous. It could be second by second, but almost everyone that offers that doesn't give it to you in real time. There has to be a lag. It has to be aggregated for a day. So if you're a high-frequency quantitative investor who wants to invest on the next millisecond, what's gone on for a day with a day lag isn't interesting to you. So they're heavy users of machine learning, but they're predominantly using sort of second-by-second market data. I think probably where we are, the sort of one-month to three-month horizon are heavy, or certainly more and more of our competitors are becoming heavier users of that type of alternative data, because again, it does sort of lend itself well to a thesis-based quantitative investing world. And then I'm sure Nathan will have comments on this as well, but BlackRock is obviously a big firm. We do all the different types of investing as well. So our fundamental equity business, who work in the sort of way Nathan's team would do, they're increasingly being encouraged to use a lot of these alternative data points as well for exactly the same reasons. And that it's, yes, that they have a very robust process where they go and meet management and they do the analysis they have, but why wouldn't they be interested in hotel bookings data that we're interpreting for hundreds of companies? Why wouldn't they use it to help inform their view about a particular hotel chain investment that they were thinking about? So I think it's the technology is very used in the shorter horizon, but maybe some of the alternative data sources less so. But it is coming in equities, it seems, across the board.
Jeff, did you want to add?
Yeah, I think so. We've talked a little about, you know, equity investors, and so I'll leave the experts to talk more about that. I think we look at, again, if you look at sort of the investment banking type user, so, you know, just across the street here, right, there's a team of junior bankers pouring through financial statements to recommend, you know, should company A acquire company B, and they'll be going through those financial statements, right, and they're very heavy users of the detailed line-by-line financial statements, but they're also looking at the non-financial information. So if it's a consumer goods company, they'll be looking for, well, what are the products they make? What are the overlaps between those products? What KPIs around those products are available? So some of that might be in segment breakdown data, but often it's not granular enough, and they go elsewhere to get that segment breakdown data. If you look at some, you know, topical thing, you know, WeWork is about to do its IPO, or trying to, right? People are looking at their financial statements, but they're also looking at governance. They're looking at the ownership structure. They're looking for, you know, and again, we get a lot of questions around, can we structure the ownership clauses, the poison pill type information? What are the covenants? What are the debt covenants in there? So fixed income investors are very interested in those structural elements and those risk factors and those kind of other, you know, discussions that are in filings. They would like us to structure that, and we do structure that for them. And I was going to say one other thing. So yes, and the fixed income investors, but also looking at, if you know, people, everyone wants to know, what's the EBITDA coverage? You know, what is the, you know, what's the number of times interest to EBITDA, right? So again, back into the EBITDA discussion that we all love. How do you put that together? So the fixed income investors looking at all those factors as well, outside of the traditional equity analysts. And on that credit risk, we actually have credit models that look at sentiment in news, sentiment in filings, sentiment in transcripts, as well as financial statements. And we combine all those factors together, and we have a model that's highly predictive of whether the traditional credit providers will upgrade or downgrade based on that. So we actually are combining non-financial data and financial data, even in our credit models.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeff. We're going to take just one more question from the floor, and I'm sorry to these people, but this question was over here first. So one more question here. Thank you, Lothar.
Yeah, thank you. It's on the impact of the technology and data availability on the investment process and the relevance of accounting. I just try to lobby it at the desk. One thing we have to, or I think is important to remember is, financial reporting is about the past. The company reports what has happened. Investing is only about the future. It's only about what will happen and how can I predict that, and therefore get an idea of what the value of the company will be that I'm going to be investing in. Now, all the data, which all the non-GAAP data, be it numerical or be it any kind of other data, is in the end used to predict reported data, because in the end you want to know what will be the cash flow, what will be the profit and so on of the company I'm looking at, because that determines the value of the company. Maybe shorter term, like with the retail customers, you may want to see better the next quarterly report, which than other investors, or the valuation of the company itself, reports which come out over the years. So basically what I'm trying to say is I don't think the discussion on whether the IFRS reporting is relevant or not, it's essentially relevant, because you have to know what you're actually predicting and how you're, like, you have to have transparency and continuity in the data reporting in order to really leverage the other non-GAAP data to predict your value of the company. That would be my assessment, and I don't know if that's seen violently differently in the panel.
I would just throw in one point about this. So I think you're right. I think financial statements are an anchor, and if we ask ourselves who pays for the preparation of financial statements and why, so it's the owners of the company who want to understand what's happening, and they want to use that financial data as a way of raising external capital as well if they need to, in terms of talking to the credit market. So all of that's absolutely true, and in a fundamental research process like ours, we are seeking to anticipate future financial statements. However, in a traded security, an owner has to take account of the volatility of price, and you get into the agency problem of what market movements do, and that does impact what the owners of companies and the people who are setting the preparation of financial accounts, what they want to achieve from it. So I think timeliness is relevant. So I agree with everything you say, but I wouldn't underestimate how important the timeliness is to asset owners.
David, would you like to add?
I mean, it's not meant to sound quite like this, but it's going to sound like quite a flippant comment, but all data is historical. I mean, whichever data source you get it from, and it's sometimes, we sort of have to say it as a quantitative investor, we're always working with historical data, whatever that data source is, to forecast the future. It's about how you interpret that information to make those forecasts, mm-hmm. and that's true whether you're interpreting accounting data or alternative data as well. So I think we'd stand by a lot of the comments previously made about what we need from accounting data and why.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to question three on the screen now. We'll take the panellists in the order we've been using, so Nathan, David, then Jeff and Christine. The question says, what are the top three things that need to happen to support investors in making decisions in a more technology-driven world?
I'm all for the faster and more accurate dissemination of information, and if digital tagging is part of that, I'm all for it. We've heard a lot about text-based analysis, and one of my desires is that there are fewer adjectives in MD&As and more numbers, and I think this body has an enormous opportunity to try to force a greater linkage between MD&A and the actual financial statements, and please eradicate adjectives and turn them into numbers where possible. The speed of dissemination, I've mentioned it a few times, and the consistency of what's produced. In all of this conversation, you've heard that financial statements are a compass, right? They present a relatively true north that we're all using to some degree to make our decisions. Knowing what was north 6 months ago, 3 months ago, 2 weeks ago is less valuable than knowing where true north is now. Those would be the kind of the priorities I would raise for what I'd want financial statements to do in the future.
Thank you. David?
The sort of disconnect in answering this question is that the more we encourage you to add more information and make that more information more standardised and higher quality and more available to other people, actually potentially reduces our potential ability to generate alpha, because a lot of our ability is interpreting unstandardized information and unstructured information better and quicker than other people, and a lot of that's having the resources and everything else you need behind that. But I think the flip side to that is, as a quantitative investor, there's some caveats to this, but generally more data is better than less data. So the more information and data points that we can get, the more timely that information is, the better. So in encouragement that more and differing things and more modern ways of assessing certain things are looked at, that we can utilise, that we can calibrate, would definitely be appreciated.
Thank you. Jeff?
Yeah, I don't know if I can add too much to that. I mean, I think just a recognition that financial statements are being processed automatically by modern machine learning capabilities, looking for sentiment, extracting values and so on, and thinking and having experts in that field as part of the standards and part of the disclosure discussions, I think is important, because there are certain elements that can be included into disclosures that would help the standardisation and the discovery of some of the KPIs and other values that we've talked about by a sort of intermediate stage, if you like, rather than saying this is a new standard and whatever, but helping to improve the disclosure of those things, particularly around risk statements and around, for example, we get asked to extract supply chain information, but the way that supply chain or supply chain risks are discussed is really not consistent across reporting, and having some element of standardization and having some element of understanding of what is capable to be extracted through machine would help, I think, set a good balance between what needs to be provided. In terms of frequency, I think, you know, as a reality is, if an airline produces weekly data to the market around, you know, what is happening, why isn't that covered by, you know, accounting and audit standards? It just doesn't seem to make any sense to me. And I think some of the industry disclosures that are made should absolutely be looked at and scrutinised, and the actual pattern of disclosure and how it's used by investors really needs to be incorporated into the standards.
That's a challenge for us. Christine?
So I guess for the financial statements to produce high quality data, consistent, relevant, timely data, going back to a point I made earlier, I do think that my wish list is to see all the different stakeholders work together, and each stakeholder taking an ownership of the part that they play. And so again, kind of revisiting the idea that, you know, companies need to be responsible for the financial statements that they tag, or when they outsource it to third-party data vendors, they need to be on top of what tags were selected, and review them and approve them. Aim for minimal data quality errors. Having also the regulators at the table as well, actually looking at the data and enforcing the data quality and making sure that companies are not creating custom tags because If they are creating custom tags when they shouldn't, they could be obfuscating the information, and that's good information for the regulators to look at, and the standard setters as well. So I really do think that, you know, all of the different stakeholders need to have a role at the table, and including the auditors as well. I believe that the XBRL financial statements should be audited, just as the underlying normal HTML is audited. The XBRL component should also be audited.
Thank you. Any final comments from panelists on that last question or on other things other people have said?
So we've talked a lot about the growth of alternative data. I don't want you to confuse the volume of it with its value. So I guess we've been on an S-curve where there's been the growth in a lot of alt data, which does have value in terms of much higher timeliness relative to financial statements, but there is definitely evidence of diminishing marginal returns in terms of what you can understand. So I still think financial statements are very, very valuable, but they are definitely a smaller proportion of the total information that goes into a prospective investment decision.
Thank you. I think I have time for at least one question, if not two. So there were questions over here previously. So, yes, the lady there, and see how long we go on that one.
Yes, well, my question is, in this context, what is the difference between an audited financial statement or non-audited financial statement? It's like you said, to have financial information queried in time consistent is expensive. So if you had to choose, you would prefer broader information non-audited or more specific audit information?
I mean, I think from my side, probably broader unaudited. This is a bit of a get out here, but again, we cover thousands of stocks. We build portfolios with hundreds of positions in, so we get huge amounts of things wrong. And some of those things are just because we've come to the wrong conclusion, and some of it is from data, lack of data cleanliness. It's just in quantitative investing, it's just one of the things that you accept, and you work to generate your results by getting the small majority of things right. So I think more information, a bit less clean for us, would be preferable way around.
Okay, what about you, Nathan?
Yeah, I'm an analyst, so I hate to say that I'm prepared to compromise accuracy of information, but I think we have to accept that accounting is just one lens on the totality of a company's operations. And if something is enormously expensive and time-consuming to produce but has limited value to its users, we have to ask whether it's worth producing. So my preference would be to try to capture or to standardise more discussion in MD&A, and you know, that would be, for me, what's really valuable. Is a lot of companies say a lot of things in MD&A that have nothing to do with financial statements, and that seems to me to be an opportunity for you to get your arms around that and force some standardisation.
Yeah, I think I'd just make the point that, you know, as a vendor, we produce a huge volume of these different data sets, and the vast majority are not from audited financial statements, and people are making, the whole world is making investment decisions not on the basis of audited financial statements. That might sound, you know, terrifying, but it's reality. You know, estimates aren't audited from the firms. The KPIs, again, keep coming back to, people are asking for that alt data to validate KPIs that companies produce, and those KPIs aren't often audited, or most of the time are not audited. You know, they provide their own type of currency adjustments. They provide other information around those KPIs. I think that's the question: is there something around standardisation and best practice that can be discussed around those things that doesn't perhaps go the full stake to audit? But people are already using that data on audit.
Just really quickly, so in the US, traditionally before inline XBRL, companies filed two separate documents with the SEC, the HTML, which is audited, and the XBRL. There was no explicit requirement for that to be audited. Now, with an inline world, when the XBRL and the HTML is one document, it kind of meshes the two pieces of information together, and it's hard to disentangle and figure out what component is audited, what component isn't audited. I think that that line is a lot more blurry. So from my perspective, a more explicit requirement to say, hey, you need to audit the metadata, the XBRL tags, as well as the traditional audit for the HTML, all of that in one package. I think having some clarity around that would make it a lot easier for the end consumer.
Panelists, you've kicked off our meeting in an excellent fashion. You've given us so much to think about, talk about, and discuss in our breakout sessions. So could you please join with me in thanking the panelists for their contribution this morning. I believe we're now breaking. Are we breaking, or yeah. What are we doing, April?
And just a few comments, just from me, and just to echo what you've said, and certainly looking at the body language of the people here, absolutely everybody was totally engaged through that, and I thought it was fabulous, and I think some real thinking for us to come from that, which leads to where we do go from here. So we are breaking now for coffee for 15 minutes, and then we are going into our breakout groups. So you have on your table your breakout groups, and there's a map there too as to where the rooms are. I'm sure that you can ask the questions during morning tea, and hopefully the panel will be able to stay for morning tea and might be inundated by people asking questions. But we have a series of breakout questions for us to consider. There are four questions. The first is, what impact will technology have on the need for IFRS standards in the future? The second, what impact will technology have on the need for the IFRS taxonomy in the future? Three, are market forces supplanting benefits of an IFRS taxonomy? And four, other takeaways from today's panel. I'm sure that each group could actually spend the whole time we have, which is an hour, on each of those questions. So I'm actually going to ask that each group start with a different question. So to make it easy, so breakout group one, do question one. Two, question two, etc. So breakout group four does question four as the starting point and then move on to the others. The key aspects that I picked up from the panel in terms of our particular thinking, and I'm sure there is many, many more thoughts around the impact on the foundation, obviously thinking about the relevance of the financial statements. I'm sure for all of us, the fact that it's moved from, say, 90% to 10%. And so what is the impact of that on us as the foundation as a whole in terms of writing standards? The impact of changes in accounting standards to the investors and the technology. The importance of XBRL for standard setting. And then our role with alternative data. Should we be encouraging it? Should we be thinking about the standardisation and our role with ESG? Who sets those reporting standards? And as somebody said, currently what accounting standards were decades ago. So those are some of the things to me in terms of thinking about the impact of what we've just heard on the future of the foundation. So, yes, let's break now for a cup of coffee and a biscuit or something, I am presuming, and at 11 o'clock move into those breakout sessions. But again, if we can thank the panel. Thank you very much.